The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters.
Relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, December 5, 2018, and this is the Bob Seska Show, interviews from Earth One. My guest today happens to be my favorite film journalist and movie critic, the great Mark Hughes from Forbes.com. Today we're going to talk with Mark about superhero movies, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the DC Extended Universe, plus we're going to spend some time on Star Wars and, of course, the front runners for Best Picture in next year's Oscars, all right? And as always, if you like what you hear, please consider supporting the show on our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/join/Bob Seska Show. And now, let's talk all things geek with Mark Hughes.
I'm a big fan of writing about politics. And obviously, I don't keep my mouth shut much on social media.
Right. So. Well, that's one of the reasons why you're great. I'd totally love to just switch places. Why don't you? You can take over my job, and you can write about politics, and I'll just write about movies. That'd be great. Yeah. I mean, of course, we're going to be talking movies and nerdy things today. So obviously, there are going to be spoilers in all of this. Just letting everybody know. You know why I want to start out, Mark, is probably the most recent bit of really interesting movie news that has dropped in the last 24 hours is this video that was produced by Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie. In which they're basically begging consumers to turn off the goddamn motion smoothing on their TVs. I mean, my question is, why do the TV manufacturers even have it turned on by default anyway? And is this like the new widescreen versus pan and scan debate? Yet another frustrating consumer level video discussion that we have to have again.
Well, I think there's a couple of things to keep in mind about this. And one of them is that the motion smoothing is something that actually works in your favor on a lot of TV programming that you watch. And without it, you would have a reverse effect where even though it causes the smoothing in movies where it might not be welcome or intended, on TV shows, if you take it off, then you're going to see an opposite problem, so to speak.
Interesting.
So it could cause shows to kind of look stuttery or otherwise
like a
as clear
fluttering almost. Yeah.
So, and then the other thing is just that I do believe that the higher frame rate will become, it kind of got introduced, I think, a little bit sooner than was expected or necessary.
Yeah. Peter Jackson and The Hobbit. Yeah.
Yeah, but when you, if you see that movie, for example, when you're watching Peter Jackson's Hobbit film in 3D, that makes a big difference because the motion smoothing, the higher frame rate produces a much stronger and clearer sense of 3D depth into the screen, as well as making those things like, you know, smog coming out of the screen at you at a high frame rate is going to look much better and more solid and realistic.
Interesting.
At that higher frame rate. I do believe as the digital becomes kind of the primary global way that films are made and viewed, even though there's a lot of us who still also, of course, love watching things shot on film, and as great as that looks, it's a lot more expensive to do it. And I think that there's a whole new younger generation who are watching these things and consuming this content on mobile devices and at home, and they like digital, and it just makes more sense to film on digital and then produce it for a wider array of mediums, so to speak. And the higher frame rate eventually, I think, is going to become standard, just because people that, you know, again, it's a younger generation, and so what they're used to watching, they don't really think that difference between digital and film is that significant necessarily.
Yeah.
And now especially, digital can reproduce what film looks like, and 3D, actually post-conversion 3D. I've done a lot of visiting of the various offices and companies that do post-conversion in 3D, and the depth of field they create and the detail and the texture they can create on film now in digital and with 3D conversion and things, you'd be hard pressed to find anyone who truly, when they sat down and you showed them something really on film and then something created digitally, but that's intended to give the look and feel and style of film, they might, a lot of people think they could tell the difference, but I think the vast majority couldn't. It's like the difference between people that get really high-end cables for their stereo and their audio compared to, some, you know, they claim they can tell a difference, but realistically, a lot of that stuff is beyond the capacity of the human ear to pick up in the first place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I get the problem, the complaints about it, but the whole higher frame rate thing, and it does make a difference if you haven't filmed a movie that way and then it's being done, it changes the look and the intent of the filmmaker. But in the long term, I'd think that this is not going to be that big of a deal, honestly.
I mean,
even though I respect what they said and I get their point for their films.
Yeah, that's a good point to bring up too, that it's happening without the intent of the filmmakers. And so, you know, something that's natively shot in high frame rate, for example, like as I said before, the Peter Jackson Hobbit movies were shot that way. And the results, of course, were jarring for those of us who are accustomed to 24 frames a second and seeing the, you know, the jitter and the little subtle things about film. And quite honestly, for someone like me who spent a considerable amount of time back before there were HD cameras trying to make video look more like film, now that that is kind of In a strange early way being reversed, where now film is like, there's a move to like make film look a little bit more TV-ish. And one of the complaints about the Hobbit movies was that they had that soap opera look, right, where everything was just too smooth and it didn't really translate well. And I'll be honest to admit that I never saw them in 3D, only because I wanted to get as close to the look of the original Lord of the Rings movies as I could, because I'm such a geek that way. But but when I actually did see it, it was jarring. And I think you are right in terms of this being a generational thing, because now you have a lot of young kids who are actually watching, and maybe even people our age, Mark. You know, I'm pushing 50, and even I've spent many, many years playing video games that are all, you know, especially the more modern video games, they're all have that high frame rate look to them, because it's not dependent on anything that's hardware driven, like an actual piece of film going through a camera. So in that respect, people are, I guess, are kind of used to it. But at the same time, when you do have filmmakers like Christopher McQuarrie and Tom Cruise, who spend a lot of time making sure their films look a certain way, and then they get handed off to home video and streaming services, and then suddenly they look completely different and they look odd. And you're so right when you say that a lot of consumers just, they won't be able to ever tell the difference. It was like, as I said before, it's like trying to convince someone who doesn't understand the black bars at the top and bottom of their screen when something was presented in widescreen in the old 4x3 televisions, right? So, yeah, it's a hard thing to relate to people, but I do admire them for at least taking a shot at it, right?
Yeah, I think it's important that people, you know, I think it's important to get the point out there that there's not just one standardized way to watch content, and it, because it works in both directions, that you don't, you know, for some of these films, you want to turn off the higher frame rate and the speed of it, because it affects how they filmed it and what it's going to look like. Yeah. And it won't really look this if it's not filmed at the higher frame rate, then, you know, I think there's a difference there in terms of not just intent, but in terms of what you actually get out of the film.
Yeah.
And these are not films. certainly the Mission Impossible movies are not movies that are shot with the intent to translate primarily to mobile devices and digital and home media, whereas I think a lot of other films, and I don't think, by the way, I don't say this as a knock at all. It's an artistic choice. And as an artist, you have a whole array of tools you can use to create your product and to create your art and to create it in a way that not only conveys the message and the imagery and the visuals and the storytelling you want, but conveys them in a way specifically for the audience you want in the way that that audience will be experiencing it. So, for example, a lot of the Marvel films are made and shot in a way that is both cinematic, but also will translate more directly and easily to home entertainment and mobile devices without losing so much in that translation. And they do it really, really well. Whereas I think, you know, for Mission Impossible, these films look great at home, but honestly, they're made very specifically for the cinematic theatrical experience and they're shot on film and it's done in a different way and with a different approach because that's the choices those artists happen to make.
Is the next step VR for films? Are we eventually going to see, I don't know, I'm just kind of looking ahead to maybe 10 years. Do you think that we're going to be watching movies in a fully immersive 3D environment where we're basically standing in the middle of the movie? Is that something that's going to happen, do you think?
You've just touched on something that is near and dear to my heart, and I just wrote something about this at Forbes, actually, because of the Ralph Breaks the Internet's there's a virtual reality experience that The Void and Industrial Light and Magic Lab created that is beyond anything I've seen or experienced before in VR. It's absolutely mind-boggling what they've done with it. The storytelling, the immersiveness of it. And yes, I do think that we're looking at eventually virtual reality, once it is mainstreamed, I think it's going to affect cinema, and I think we're going to start seeing experimental movies that take virtual reality and the opportunities it provides for that kind of an immersive experience. Mm-hmm. So you could go into, I'll put it this way. When I did Ralph Breaks VR, you're untethered. There's no wires. It's wireless. Wow. So you put on a helmet, a very light helmet. The visor comes down, and it's a full field of vision. It's not small goggles. It's not heavy. It's not weighing your face down. There's no cords coming off of it. And then you put on what is kind of like a very lightweight sort of, if you've ever played laser tag, the vest you wear for laser tag, but it's a motion capture type suit thing. And then the location technology that they have, you put this on and then you walk through a door and you're inside the movie.
Oh my God.
A Pixar cartoon.
Wow.
And you walk through it. And I don't just mean a small space like, you know, I love the IMAX virtual reality centers where you go in and you've got like a large cubicle sized space you can move around in. But this, you're going through doorways, you're jumping onto transport ships that are flying through a city, you're interacting with a team of people and you can see each other in it and you're all cartoon characters.
Yeah.
And it's a large space and you're moving throughout it and, When you reach out to interact with the space around you, for example, you walk through a door and you're going through a path and you're going through buildings and you walk through a doorway and you come out on a catwalk on the side of a building or a balcony sort of thing and there's a rail and I reached out to see what was really there and it was a rail and I felt a rail in front of me.
Oh my God! How did that happen? What was actually there?
I don't know because you're wearing the gear so you don't know what the actual setup looks like.
Huh.
But it's somehow they have made a large thing where you walk through it and you don't have to like go slow or feel for to not trip. Everything you're seeing in front of you is going through buildings, jumping from a scaffold onto a spaceship, flying over the city. All of this stuff it's happening in a way that you can do it without worrying that you're going to trip. There's no wires. You're not bumping into things. There's nothing there that you can't see. Yet it's all a cartoon city and a cartoon world and buildings and spaceships. And it's so big and you're walking around through it. I don't really know fully how. I mean, I have an idea of how they accomplished it, but it's the cutting edge, but it's just pushing open the envelope to a whole new experience. You'll be able to go into these things. You'll be able at some point in the next 5 or 10 years to go into a room with other people, put the gear on, and it won't just be animation. They'll have really high quality video, like a movie, and then you'll be watching a movie, but you'll be in it, and yeah, you'll have the choice to walk out of one room into another, and some other aspect of the story will be taking place. And each time you go into the movie, you'll be able to see it from different perspectives and see different clues or story elements or characters that you maybe didn't see the first time you saw it. It'll be kind of like Choose Your Own Adventure,
but yeah,
a movie, and the storytelling, because for Ralph Breaks VR, I mean, they had the screenwriter from who worked on the film come in and write this and have to consider, like, well, what if people choose to go this way? And what if they choose not to do this particular thing, and instead they do this other thing, or they stay behind or whatever? So you have to write your story in a way where you take into account what's happening off screen, so to speak, for each scene.
Yeah.
So there's really multiple ways you can interact with the movie. And it'll be a kind of almost open world in that regard.
Yeah, it seems
very
like,
cool.
As opposed to, in fact, very similar to 3D. I mean, the modern version of 3D movies that we see now. It seems to me as if that's going to be just another option for filmmakers, where, you know, you can have a filmmaker who wants to present something shot on film, 24 frames a second, your standard traditional movie, whereas some filmmakers may choose, like they do right now with 3D cameras and so on, or even IMAX cameras in some cases, to use the VR technology for their storytelling. And because, I mean, obviously there's going to be a market for people to want to participate in certain movies, and there's going to be a market for people who just want to sit back and enjoy the movie sitting in a chair eating popcorn. And so I think all of these things can eventually coexist, whether we're talking about VR or high frame rate or whatever, much like black and white film can coexist with color film. And I'm sure there was plenty of backlash, and certainly you're much more of a film historian than I'll ever be, so I mean, obviously we saw a similar kind of backlash, right, when there was sound introduced, or when there was color introduced, or when CinemaScope was introduced. These were all things, right, that were yes, met with skepticism, weren't they?
Absolutely. Color was considered a fad. Sound was considered a fad.
Yeah.
People thought it was a distraction, that it wasn't real art. You heard all of these same claims about what was and wasn't that you hear now. I mean, the debate over this and over content being adapted in sequels, every argument you hear today was going on back in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. You can pick even the eras that people consider like the golden age of cinema, the 30s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. Look at most of the content being made. It was mostly adaptations or sequels or cheap kind of fad stuff over and over. The arguments about whether, oh, well, is color going to stay? Do you really want to film in color? Do you want to use sound?
Mm-hmm.
What about music? All of those things, those were big discussions that were happening, and people were bemoaning, oh, the studio system. Oh, why can't they do original content? Oh, as a performer, but oh, these things that are just fads. Mm-hmm. Oh, where's it going to go? Oh, why is it all just driven by studios want money and profits and IP? They're treating it like it's some sort of business where people expect to make money instead of just producing things that I want personally to watch. It's the same kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So this has been going on forever.
Yeah, and along those lines, for some reason, the death of Stan Lee gave non-comic fans an excuse to scream about too many superhero movies. And of course, we saw Bill Maher, who was particularly egregious with his views on the death of Stan Lee. And he suggested that superhero movies are kind of to blame for the, I don't know what he said, the infantilization of America. Like, everyone's just, like, wallowing in their toddlerhood or something like that because of these comic book movies. And it turns out there were many more dramatic and even documentary films than there were comic book movies in 2018. In fact, I had to look it up because I like to look at statistics. And one of the statistics I saw were that if you were to take action and adventure movies as a whole, we're talking about around 90 films in 2018 were fit into those categories, either comic book movies or adventure movies like Star Wars and so on. But then I notice, 250 dramas were released in 2018. 131. This is the really shocking number that I saw. 131 documentary movies released in 2018. It's not so much a matter, or maybe a combination of several things, but it's not just so much a matter of studios forcing comic book movies down the throats of moviegoers. It's a matter of what's being promoted, what moviegoers are want to see, what they have a penchant for seeing in the theaters versus what they're going to wait for on home video or streaming or some other format. It seemed utterly ridiculous. It seemed like an excuse to just beat up on superhero movies because of some some archaic old view of comic books being like, you know, everyone thinks of comic books as being this thing that was around in the 1950s and 60s that was really cheesy and campy and they don't have any sense of what comic books have become certainly in the modern era, but probably since 1970 forward, being darker, more dramatic, more interesting in terms of its artwork and its story arcs and its character development and so on. And were you as frustrated as the rest of us were seeing these views pop up as they did, you know, piggybacking off the death of Stan Lee?
Well, sadly, it's so common that I'm used to it, so it's hard for me to even get frustrated by seeing really? Bill Maher is being a grumpy, old, self-centered white guy who doesn't get something that he has a strong opinion about? Like, color me shocked. Not Bill Maher, you know. Breaking news, Bill Maher is still Bill Maher. That's kind of his thing.
Yeah.
He has strong, obnoxious opinions about things that he knows very little about and isn't very qualified to talk about half the time. But honestly, the situation is, I'd be surprised if Bill Maher has seen very many of the modern superhero films at least from the last 10 years. He probably hasn't watched very many of them. He's probably the sort of guy that says, oh, well, they used to make great original films that, you know, oh, really? Back when people weren't infantilized, back when a white man, middle-aged man like him could go to the movies and watch Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dance repeatedly in fantasy escapist things where they're just singing and dancing and there's not addressing any serious issues whatsoever and the man gets his way and women know their place and all that kind of crap that is completely the foundation of infantilized men who, like Bill Maher, who, you know, Bill Maher has some good political opinions,
sure,
but, you know, like it, like a broken clock on a wall is going to be right a few times a day. I kind of give Bill Maher a hard time, but he deserves it because he can be a real jackass. And in the aftermath of Stan Lee's passing, to see somebody like Stan Lee, who changed the face of not only comic books, but as it turns out, cinema, because he was way ahead of the curve trying to get people to take comics seriously and adapt them into good content for a long time. He died. A lot of people were expressing their grief about it, and Bill Maher saw it as a chance to get attention for himself. When, you know, if he can't get attention, like a lot of people, if he can't get attention by saying something smart, he's going to go for getting attention by saying something stupid. And these comic book films are, I mean, was he back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, was he bemoaning all of these ridiculous biblical films and Roman mythology films and sandals and sword films that were made that were all about mythology, be it biblical or Greek mythology or Old Testament mythology, that were all being translated into film because people respond to mythology that speaks to these larger concepts about the human condition while presenting us with fantastical stories that excite us and entertain us at all ages? Comics do that, and anyone who watches a film like The Dark Knight, for example, or watches a film like Captain America the Winter Soldier that is about the post-9/11 national security state and the idea that the villains of the movie decided they didn't need to have their own separate villainous group. They would just join the United States government because it was already essentially headed in the direction that they wanted to go. That's some pretty serious political examination.
Yeah.
And I think there's worthwhile messaging there within the larger context of a superhero film. But there's nothing, the difference between a superhero film that Bill Maher makes fun of and an action movie that he likes is whether or not the character wears a mask part of the time. And frankly, most of the Marvel and DC movies are better and smarter than probably a large percentage of the action movies or even the political dramas and things that Bill Maher watches and takes seriously as serious art.
Right.
There's not that many of them. There are right now, I have a list of contenders for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. I've got 23 movies on it. 23 possible, very valid, strong contenders for Best Picture this year.
Yeah.
Not even going into the really dark horse or outlier stuff. So find me a movie in the 30s or a year rather. Find me any year in the 30s or 70s when you could find 2 to 3 dozen movies that were valid, serious films that were contenders for Best Picture.
Oh, yeah.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And in fact, you mentioned just a second ago that had Bill Maher seen any of these movies? Well, it turns out that he was actually in one. He was actually in Iron Man 3, for God's sake. Yeah. So Bill Maher has collected a check from a comic book movie, and a pretty damn good one at that. It's just so strange that I ended up actually arguing with friends over whether comic books and album covers, for that matter, should be considered art. And like, this is even a point of discussion in 2018, just still amazes me and a little bit disturbs me too. So
it's not even a there's, if you go to France, for example, or go to Japan and try to even have a conversation that pretends that there's even a question about whether comic books are valid art, they'll look at you like you're crazy, because comics they are considered art, and they're considered serious art and taken seriously, and adults read them. Just, you know, it's like film or like any medium. There's some stuff that's just for kids, some that's all ages, some that's just for adults.
Yeah.
It's just another medium for telling stories, like, you know, literature or any other form of art. So it's this idea that comics are not serious art and shouldn't be treated as serious art is very particular to Western culture.
Yeah. You certainly won't see it in Japan. I mean, in Japan, they highly, highly reveal manga and anime as legitimate art forms, as legitimate filmmaking, as it should be. It seems to me that there shouldn't even, I even sometimes argue with the concept of there being a separate category for quote unquote animated films, insofar as they just happen to be animated. It's just like a movie just happening to be in color, or just happening to be in surround sound, or for that matter, in 3D or high frame rate or whatever. And so, and I think that that's how they regard things like animated movies, certainly comic book movies in other countries. And it just seems like in the United States, where most of that is consumed by a vast majority of Americans, it seems to me as if it's still in that regard a whipping boy among people who generally don't see those movies anyway. But it's striking to me how many people actually believe that there's nothing but superhero movies in cinemas today, which is completely and totally ridiculous. And you know what?
Yeah,
remind me, I want to come back to your Oscars list here in just a second, because there's a lot to talk about there too. But one of the many areas where I'm in the obvious minority is my enjoyment of the DC Extended Universe movies. I'm saying that almost as if I'm like, you know, like we've got George H.W. Bush's funeral going on right now. It's almost as if I went on Twitter and complimented George H.W. Bush. It seems like I have to do this underground in a way, when I talk about the DCEU, because it is such a divisive and controversial topic. And I don't think it really should be, but it just happens to be. I mean, I genuinely love Man of Steel. And again, I feel a little like my face is starting to blush a little bit, because I'm saying I actually really enjoyed the Ultimate Edition of Batman versus Superman. It's strange to hear that spoken out loud, but I tend to respond to Zack Snyder's ambition as a filmmaker so much that I tend to forgive some of his missteps. Am I completely off base with this, Mark?
No, not at all. I'll die on that hill defending Batman versus Superman. I love Batman versus Superman. My review was considered apparently very controversial because I said I thought it was a triumphant film and a great, a spectacular, deep, complex human drama.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the film. I've liked everything that I've seen from Zack Snyder, which is every film he's made.
Yeah.
I've liked all of them. I liked Sucker Punch, and I'll even defend Sucker Punch and point people to there are several feminist blogs that defend that movie and say that, you know, a lot of people don't get it and how much that film had a whole subtext about male gaze in gaming and genre mm-hmm. entertainment and was very much a deconstruction of the male audience perceptions of women in genre entertainment.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it a lot. I understand why there are some folks who don't enjoy it, but Dawn of the Dead, I think, is spectacular. I'm one of the people who thinks that Snyder's remake is superior to mm-hmm. the original even, which I also love. I love 300.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of Man of Steel. I love Batman versus Superman. I'm pretty sure I would have loved and absolutely possibly worshipped Zack Snyder's version of Justice League. You know, hopefully will. I love the parts of his that he did that I did get to see. I enjoyed the film overall for what it was, and you know I like it and I can enjoy it. But I have no doubt that Zack Snyder's vision for that film and what he intended and the film that he shot is something that I would have really loved and liked a lot better, honestly.
Well, I can boil it all down to this as far as Justice League goes, and that is that I get the sense that if Zack Snyder had stayed on as the director until the premiere, until the movie had been locked, the final cut was in place, and everything was ready to roll into cinemas, that we never, ever in a million years would have seen such a shoddy piece of visual effects as was that ridiculous mouth replacement on Henry Cavill. And I'll tell you right now, I'll be abundantly clear and upfront about this. I've had a complete man crush on Henry Cavill for years now, since Man of Steel. And when I saw, apart from being a Batman super fan, I walked into Justice League so eagerly anticipating seeing the Trinity together with Aquaman and Cyborg. And then the first shot comes up and it's Henry Cavill looking like ass. I mean, just with that awful, awful face replacement, because, of course, going back to Christopher McQuarrie, Henry Cavill still had the mustache from Mission Impossible. And they right. and because of all kinds of behind the scenes intrigue and controversy and who knows who's to blame this way or that way, they had to replace that his entire mouth area. And it was so terrible looking that I simply can't overcome such an obvious glitch. And again, if Zack Snyder had stayed on, I don't think that would have ever been acceptable to him, and nor would he have allowed that to happen.
It wouldn't have been necessary either, because if Zack had stayed on, and you know, I just want to preface my remarks by saying that the terrible, heartbreaking tragedy that the Snyder family experienced it was absolutely understandable that he had to step away. It reached a point where that was necessary. And it's completely understandable. So I think the smart move would have been to delay Justice League and push it back to the next year and then release it in the spring around the same time Batman versus Superman dropped.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, sometime in that time frame, sometime in the March to April frame. Or if not that, move it to late July, the window when the Dark Knight films were really produced big time box office for Warner Brothers. If they had delayed the film and given Zack Snyder the time he needed to go be with his family and then come back and finish the film, I think from everything I've heard, I strongly believe it would have been entirely possible for Zack to do that and bring a film to theaters that was his vision and was true to his creative vision for that film while also satisfying the needs of the studio. So, you know, Joss Whedon writing the extra scenes that were needed and that were wanted for that film, that could have been done, and then Zach could have come back and shot those scenes himself. Henry could have shaved by then. And then there would have been a lot more time to get all everything finished and completed in the visual effects for the new sequences. But by and large, I think if Zach had stayed on, really it was just a question of he needed a little bit of extra time to finish it. But I think we have to be realistic about the fact that the studio had different things that they wanted out of the film at that point. They considered it a wash, sort of. They wanted to put it out there and get it done and be able to move on, because they were at that point, I think it was obvious that they were going to go in a new direction, and they anticipated that everything was going to change for the future of the DC films. So, you know, and there's other things that I could say about it that I'll just keep my mouth shut.
Well, sure.
I have a lot of frustration about how that went down, and that Zach did not get to release the film he wanted to release. But at the same time, it is what it is. It's water under the bridge. And maybe someday we'll get to see Zach's finished version. And, you know, I will say I was reluctant. I kind of went back and forth. I'll say this. I think it's possible for a version of this film to be released on home entertainment that would make fans happy and that would satisfy Zack Snyder's whatever desire he has in his heart for people to see his intended vision. I think that's there. I think it's possible that will happen someday, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. But I do think it will happen at some point. It'll be possible.
Yeah, I think a lot of us who like Zack Snyder and who thought there were missteps in the final cut of Justice League. Not that I really like Joss Whedon too, but I mean the fact of the matter is that it was hurried at the end, and there were those big visual effects mistakes, like the Cavill mouth replacement. But I mean, when it all comes down to it, I mean, I'd be satisfied to see an ultimate edition of Justice League come out that has the junky XL score put back in. I'd like to see the Superman face replacement fixed by reshooting. I mean, they can just do a head replacement on Cavill. They can just reshoot it, replace the head, and it'll be minimal fuss. I mean, in fact, all of these changes together, including this one, that I'd like to see the backstories of Flash and Aquaman put back in, that, you know, all these things can be done in just a few weeks on a relatively minimal budget. But I mean, obviously there is a much larger possibility of maybe a Snyder cut still being out there that they could go in and finish up. And that's still a lingering question mark. And of course I would love to see that. And because there's an overall look that, and a style of storytelling that Zack Snyder brought to the table for the DCEU. And I think that it was not well received by some audience members, because everyone was kind of expecting, well, Marvel's been doing this and they've got kind of a style and they've got jokes and they've got the primary colors and everything in their movies. Why aren't they doing Superman like that? Why aren't they doing Batman like that? And it seems to me as if history is going to be much kinder to Zack Snyder's vision than I think critics were going in as those movies were being released contemporaneously. And so, because I think it's because of Zack Snyder's different vision. He took a very different approach to the films. It was a very ambitious approach, a very comic faithful approach to these movies. I think much more comic faithful than Marvel, although I'm not into this whole Marvel versus DC thing. I like all the Marvel movies, or most of the Marvel movies, about as much as I like the DC movies too. So it's just, I'm one of these guys who, when I look at a Zack Snyder film, I see the ambition in it, and I think ambition is good. I see just maybe some of the finest cinematography, some of the finest shot choices, and some of the most interesting visual filmmaking of any movies that we're seeing, comic book movies or otherwise. Is that too far off base, or is that pretty much it with him?
No, I agree. I agree. I think that I think that Zack Snyder's DC movies are going to they're going to age well. And yeah. even though I know a lot of people currently, if you ask them, well, what do you think about Batman versus Superman now, today, there's still plenty of people and critics who will say bad things about that movie. But I think it's we're maybe, you know, another 5 years or so. I've said for a long time that I thought about 10 years out, we'd start seeing reassessments of Batman versus Superman, yeah. especially the Ultimate Cut.
Yes.
Which got a better reception from a lot of critics, including critics who were very negative toward the theatrical cut.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the biggest problem that existed for the DCEU is that it took a very deconstructive approach to the superhero genre. And I think they felt that was safe because they thought, look, Marvel is doing a more direct, straightforward, from the start, origins and everything kind of approach to the superhero films. So they were able to do that, and then Marvel started working toward deconstruction later after establishing them. And I think Warner and Zack Snyder felt that it was possible to jump right in with the DC movies and say, look, the superhero genre itself has been established long enough. People get it. These characters, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, have been around long enough. People get it. They know already. We don't have to revisit everything. So we can go straight into an alternate approach to these films and to this storytelling. And so it started with a deconstruction that was intended to take them apart, figure out what makes them tick and what makes them work, what makes them not work, and then reassemble them again in a new way going forward.
Yeah.
And that was something that I think was bold, and I think it was, like you said, it was very ambitious, and it did reflect a very particular perspective in the comics, a perspective that a lot of people like Zack Snyder, like me, I grew up in, I was a teenager in the 80s when the Dark Knight Returns
Dark Knight,
and
yeah.
Watchmen and a whole lot of that modern deconstructive approach to comic book storytelling kind of was took off and popularized it and got mainstream respect from the media. But I think it's very easy for us as fans to look at that and to use our own experiences and our own background knowledge about these characters and our understanding of their relationships and everything and walk into the Zack Snyder films and embrace them. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing. But I think unfortunately, a lot of the mainstream public, they don't live and breathe this stuff the way we do. They aren't familiar. There is a large portion of the population that will ask you, well, why wasn't Batman in the Avengers? You know, that, or where was Spider-Man during Batman versus Superman? Why weren't the Avengers there? They don't really necessarily get or even care about those particular distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's less true today. I think the mainstream audience has generally come to understand the division between Marvel and DC and that they don't overlap and stuff. But there's still people out there who don't. I think that's really the foundational problem, so to speak, with why the DCEU films haven't performed better is because they defied audience expectations about the construction, you know. And I think people wanted to see more of Superman and Batman and invest in these new iterations of them before they were ready to embrace a deconstruction of them.
Interesting. Yeah, and do you think that's the core of why audiences generally... I mean, we forget, by the way, that Man of Steel did extraordinarily well in the box office. So did Batman v Superman. But I think people went into those movies with a pre-existing bias against Zack Snyder as a filmmaker so that they were ready... It's almost like with, it's a weird kind of comparison to draw. It's almost like with Lance Armstrong, where anything that's related to Lance Armstrong, even a cancer foundation, is going to have a particular taint when it comes to certain people. And I think that's what happened with Zack Snyder, where people were, they were hoping it would fail because they just don't like Zack Snyder. And I don't know exactly why that is, because as I was saying before, he seems to check all the boxes, visually interesting, challenging storyteller. He's got, oh my God, I mean, if you're a comic fan, the number of references, if you follow his Vero account, he's constantly posting interesting, not only references to comic books and really obscure ones. I mean, really, I mean, even like the shape of the hole that Batman made when Superman threw him through the wall. The shape of the hole is a very specific comic reference. I mean, down to things like that. So it seems to me as if it's, from the outside, it's a shoe-in, but if you've got that anti-Snyder bias, it's going to be a challenge to overcome that.
I think that there is, I think there's some nuance to this to consider and to think about and to remember, because there was a time when Zack Snyder actually, when Dawn of the Dead, 300, and Watchmen were all very well, pretty well received critically. Yeah. Dawn of the Dead was really well received. And 300 was considered pretty visionary filmmaking. And Watchmen was popular at the time with critics, but then became even more popular as time went by. People continued to look back at it and be like, wow, that really is one of the masterpieces of the superhero and comic book genre.
Yeah.
So those first three films, all his first three feature films, all got good reviews and were well received. It was... what is the film? The Legend of the Guardians, the animated film.
Oh, yeah.
The Owls of Ga'Hoole. Yeah. And then Sucker Punch. Those two films back to back Legend of the Guardians was more mixed. I think it got better than 50% at Rotten Tomatoes, which doesn't represent acclaim, obviously, but clearly I think it had majority good reviews.
Yeah.
Sucker Punch was the first Zack Snyder film that got majority bad reviews and that was really kind of hit hard by critics that just mocked it and criticized it bad.
Mm-hmm.
But then with Man of Steel actually came very close to a fresh at Rotten Tomatoes, and it did 56%. So it definitely got more than majority support, so to speak, from critics who liked it and gave it good reviews. It was Batman versus Superman when the whole negativity towards Zack Snyder actually seemed to take off, and when you saw a lot more people suddenly pretending that they never liked anything he made, and you see a lot of critics who are like, "Oh, Zack Snyder's not a good filmmaker," and I look at it and I'm like, "Well, wait a minute, you gave his first three films good reviews." Half of you gave Legend of the Guardians good reviews, and more than half of you liked Man of Steel. So where's this coming from?
Yeah.
If the majority of you liked all of his previous films except one, then where's this idea coming from that suddenly, oh, Zack Snyder's the problem. Zack Snyder's not a good... People were calling him a visionary filmmaker right up until Batman v Superman.
Unbelievable. And that was his most visionary movie, as far as I'm concerned. Batman v Superman.
I still rank Watchmen as still, when I look at all of his films, Watchmen is the one that I think is a true, like, every time I watch it, especially the ultimate cut of Watchmen.
Oh my God,
that incorporates all the deleted footage and then also the animation. If I watch that and then I watch it and then I also watch the little fake documentary show Under the Hood with it, I'm just blown away by the ambition and how incredible this was. He made a film that Terry Gilliam said was unmakeable and was unfilmable, that so many people just gave up on and did not think could be made. And he made a version that I think is arguably, in some regards, even better than the comic.
Yeah,
and made so many smart, complicated artistic choices about looking at the comic and saying, well, what it did for the comic medium and looking at ways to incorporate literature and articles and books and other and mass media. Zack Snyder said, okay, I'm going to adapt it and I'm going to use cinema and the various possibilities in cinema to explore the same ideas and concepts that Watchmen explored about the use of violence, about vigilantism in the West, about the idea of using some form, that there's some sort of way if we could just find the ultimate application of violence that would achieve the ultimate peace. Mm-hmm. And that's a really grounding theme throughout the Watchmen comic. And Zack Snyder, I think, really appropriately translated that into film. And if you watch it, it's just, there's so much, it's so rich with ideas and with what's possible in the medium to make you question the entire comic book superhero medium itself.
Yeah.
And what is it teaching us and what's it turning us into?
You know, I want to go up to him and say, keep doing what you're doing. And I know he's got a family to feed and so on and you know, bills to pay. But I want to tell Zack Snyder that, you know what, some of us got it. And don't forget that. And please, if you can, keep going in some capacity. Don't let the haters get you down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because, I mean, I feel like that, especially you and I, Mark, planting our flag now, that sometime in the future, people will come around and see these movies for the quality filmmaking that they are, for the unique filmmaking they are from a comic book movie perspective. And I hope that day eventually comes. But, you know, you wrote something recently that John Krasinski should perhaps replace Henry Cavill as Superman. What was your calculus on that?
Well, I like, you know, I'm a fan of Henry Cavill's yeah. Superman. I liked his Superman in these movies, but I like to do my best to separate my personal preferences. And I'm very upfront about my preferences and what I like and what I don't like. And I'll be very honest about how I feel about movies and actors and things. But separate from whatever else I think about it, you know, I'd be happy to see Henry Cavill play Superman in a Superman and a Man of Steel sequel, and then in another Justice League. I'd be happy to see him continue in the role.
Yeah.
But at this point, realistically, I think the calculus, as you put it, is Henry Cavill has been Superman in a lot of movies, and for whatever reason, outside of DC fans like you and I, he doesn't seem to have really connected solidly with the global mainstream audience that buy the majority of tickets to these movies. Mm-hmm. Man of Steel, it made about $668 million, I think, but that was lower than what they expected.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
the
studio was thinking $700 to $800 million because of the pedigree with Christopher Nolan's name attached and David Goyer's name attached, having just come off of the, you know, over $1 billion success, back-to-back $1 billion Batman movies. Mm-hmm. Here's this new Superman movie. It's doing this, giving it the Dark Knight treatment, so to speak, to Superman. Those trailers really were compelling and got really strong positive reactions. So I think it's fair to say that while Man of Steel did, of course, make blockbuster box office and performed well, it also performed lower than it had the potential to perform. And when you translate, for example, Superman Returns box office, if you take the money Superman Returns made, which was, you know, it was like in the $400 million range, and then look at that and say, okay, if we adjust it for the larger number of theaters that Man of Steel released in, and then we adjust for inflation, and then we adjust for 3D ticket pricing, then actually the distance between Superman Returns and Man of Steel is pretty narrow.
Yeah.
And then you have to factor in that it had Christopher Nolan and David Goyer attached, and all of those things taken into account, yeah, I think it's fair to say that Man of Steel could have and should have performed north of $700 million, probably. Mm. And I know that's what they were hoping with $700 to $800 million range, that they'd really just kind of come out the gate, just blasting the doors off it with this first DCEU movie. And Henry Cavill's Superman, he was good in that role, but I don't think he's ever been, I don't think his Superman has ever connected in that way that generates hope and optimism and a sense of, yeah, you know, that mainstream audiences just cheer Henry Cavill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no slight against him. It just, it happened. And I think it happened because, again, the concept of deconstructing these characters and not taking more time to establish Superman before he was killed. I mean, he was killed off in his second appearance.
Yeah.
And he never had a film where the world rallied around Superman and loved Superman. We never saw that Superman. He was always kind of upset and disappointed that the world wasn't living up to his expectations.
Yeah.
and had such a bad opinion of him.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's funny because it ultimately, I think, comes down to the script when it comes to Cavill Superman. And I think if he gets that Christopher Reeve script, the sort of hopeful do-gooder, cat in a tree kind of Superman, I think people would embrace Henry Cavill Superman a little bit more. But I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned The Dark Knight, is The Dark Knight the best comic book movie ever made?
No, I don't. I love The Dark Knight, yeah. And it's one of the greatest. But and I know I'm going to catch flack for this, but The Dark Knight isn't even, in my opinion, the best of the Christopher Nolan Batmans. I think
really?
I still believe Batman Begins is the ultimate Batman movie.
Yeah,
and I think it's the best Batman origin story in any mm-hmm. medium, and I think it's the best single Batman story. It's the best Batman film. And I think The Dark Knight comes in second behind that in yeah. Christopher Nolan's films. But I would honestly, and I'm really going to catch a lot of flack for this, but I said this in my Forbes review, as far as pure, like, just not superhero comic book movies, adaptations, I think Infinity War is the best one ever made. I think
yeah.
it's the ambition and the scale and what they did in that and the emotional heart and the imagery. It is everything that a superhero film, when you think about what is possible and you read comics and say, what could superhero film making achieve if it just got everything right? And I look at Infinity War and I say, that's what that represents.
That's it. Yeah. You know what? I couldn't agree with you more. I stepped out of Infinity War thinking, wow, that was just comic book movie history right there. That was the best comic book movie I've ever seen. And much like you, I mean, I'm really, really partial to the Christopher Nolan movies. As I said, I really love Batman v Superman and Man of Steel. But there was something about Infinity War that just was so visually spectacular in and of itself. I mean, the number of locations and the way they split up the characters and how everything ended up without spoiling the ultimate outcome of Infinity War. How do you think the Russo brothers are going to resolve all of this with the next movie coming up?
I have to be careful because I've heard things about it. So I'll say what I will say is I think that I walked out of Infinity War, and before I heard anything about where it was going, and I knew nothing about the sequel at all, mm-hmm. and I walked out of Infinity Wars thinking, Doctor Strange gave up that stone a little too quick.
Yeah.
We know that he can put spells on things. Where was it hiding? Where did he have it that he pulled it from? And my guess was he used that stone so that he gave the stone to Thanos, but that it had some sort of spell on it so that when Thanos used the gauntlet and snapped his fingers, rather than killing everyone, it instead sent them to some alternate time.
Wow.
It sent them for, and my guess at the time, I thought he did it so that it would send them all into the future so that, because he looked at every possible outcome and he said, there's only one way to win. And he specifically said to Tony, if it ever comes down to the stone or saving you and Spider-Man, my first priority is protecting the stone.
Yeah.
And then he says, before he disappears, he says a couple of things. And one of the things Doctor Strange says is, it was the only way. And he says, we're in the end game now, or something to that effect. And that means to me, that's all a sign that Doctor Strange saw there was only one way to win.
Mm-hmm.
He had to give that stone to Thanos in order for them all to win in the future. And so he did something.
Yeah.
Doctor Strange did something that would ensure it was possible to defeat Thanos. I don't think all those people are coming back. I think some of them will stay dead. And I think some of them are the ones who do come back are going to die again. So to me, my expectation is that a couple of the core Avengers are going to be gone.
Ah, wow.
That I think that's inevitable.
Yeah.
I think two of them are going to die, and I think one of them is going to retire permanently and will just make cameos in future films, but won't be necessarily come back as a full-fledged Avenger in those films.
Is it true that they reshot some of the scenes from the Battle of New York from the first Avengers movie in preparation for the movie coming up in the spring?
Can you say that again? My headphones fell off, actually.
That's okay. No problem.
I forgot they were on a cord, and I leaned back too far, and they popped right off my head.
Happens to me more than I'd like to admit. What I said was, you know, I heard that they were refilming some specific scenes from the Battle of New York from the first Avengers movie in preparation for Avengers 4, which to me would indicate some sort of time travel involved. So I think you may be on to something with this, with the Doctor Strange angle on the stone.
Yeah. Now, they've said publicly, the claim from the Russo brothers is, well, remember Barf, the technology that Tony had in Civil War that allows him to put it on and then see the past and re-experience the past?
Mm-hmm.
The claim from the Russos is that that's what was going on when you saw the footage of, and you know, or the when you heard that they were filming scenes related to the first Avengers movie.
Yeah. Is there, and this is again related to Disney and Marvel, and now we've got this purchase of 20th Century Fox by Disney, and the possibility of a new series of Fantastic Four movies. The Fantastic Four are some of my favorite comic book characters of all time. I love these characters, but for some reason they just have never been able to do it correctly on film. They've never been able to really capture the Fantastic Four in either iteration. I know the more recent iteration was kind of meddled with by the studio, you know, the typical stories that we tend to hear about these things. Why has it been such a challenge to nail the Fantastic Four, and are we going to eventually see a genuine full-on Marvel Studios movie of the Fantastic Four?
Yeah, I'll answer the last question first. Yeah, there's going to be a Fantastic Four movie, definitely. And I think that it will come sooner rather than later. I think we'll see that before we see the X-Men. The X-Men are a little more complicated to incorporate into the MCU just because, you know, we've been watching the MCU for a long time now. There's so many films into it, and the idea that there is suddenly this whole mutants with superhuman powers out there that nobody has seen and that we haven't been introduced to or heard talked about is a little hard. Now, it's possible they could just bring them in and be like, boom, Charles Xavier was keeping the world from remembering or perceiving the existence of mutants until he felt the time was right. They could do that.
Yeah.
They could just say, we're not going to have mutants have existed for a long time. Just a few of them, like Wolverine and maybe Magneto and Charles Xavier, where there was an earlier generation where just a handful of mutants existed, but most of them committed suicide or died or just lost their powers or whatever. And that the big explosion of mutants could come as a result of some event that happens, perhaps an event that changes history.
Hey, that sounds like a good
maybe
idea.
Maybe something's going to happen in an upcoming Avengers movie that could cause something that that causes a change in the time stream and that causes the genetic mutation to manifest. Who knows?
Wow.
These things are just big questions we have to ask ourselves. But going forward, I think the Fantastic Four is going to get the full Marvel treatment. I think the potentials we've seen. Look, there's already been a great Fantastic Four movie made. It was called The Incredibles, and there's a sequel for it out right now. Uh-huh. So we know that it's possible. And I'll even say this: the very early Fantastic Four, not the most recent one, but the previous one, and then the sequel, Rise of the Silver Surfer. Those movies were imperfect and by a long shot, and they do not represent what, you know, the maximum potential of Fantastic Four on film by any stretch. That, no pun intended, by any stretch. But that that said, somebody's going to throw rocks at me now, sorry. That said, they were also, they kind of got the Fantastic Four relationships right. Those characters, especially Ben and Johnny, were extremely accurately realized and had great performances in them.
Right. Do you think it's going to... Oh, yeah, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, the sound dropped there for a second. I rewatched those films, especially, by the way, you can get the extended cuts of them on DVD, and I highly recommend it because there's a lot of really good character stuff in there that fleshes it out. And I look at that and I think, well, if a failed Fantastic Four movie and sequel can be that close anyway, and on their own in the pre-Marvel era, they were entertaining films.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't bad. They were some of the more accurate Marvel adaptations, and more faithful adaptations. Then I can only imagine what's possible with Kevin Feige at the helm, you know.
Is the have you heard anything along the lines of whether the Marvel Fantastic Four is going to be the Josh Trank cast, or is it going to be a new cast?
Oh no, that's all. None of the X-Men cast or Fantastic Four cast will carry forward. Marvel does it, it's a full reboot. A full reboot.
Okay.
There's not going to be. I mean, maybe Ryan Reynolds will continue in it just because the potential, because of what the character represents, they could play off of the fact that he's like, hey, why is everybody different? Or, you know, that
sure.
It would be great to see him do that, to see him trying to curse and then kind of a thing like The Good Place where maybe he says, it'd be great actually to see Deadpool say, holy forking shirt balls on in a Marvel movie. It would be a really fun nod, and I'm obsessed with the Good Place, so I'd love any kind of Easter egg references to it. But yeah, besides Ryan Reynolds, I don't think we're going to see any. I'm pretty positive. I'll say I'm pretty positive that no, we're not going to see any of the Fox movie cast for any of the Fox superhero films continue forward. When they are in the MCU, it's going to be a full reboot.
Just out of nowhere, if you could recast Wolverine with any actor of your choosing, who would it be? Is that a tough one? That's a tough one. Because you know what? I'm asking that question. I have no idea the answer to that question. I couldn't even tell you who I would begin to choose as Wolverine.
If you want to go older, if you were going to try to kind of continue generally the Hugh Jackman approach to the character, Justin Theroux from The Leftovers
would not
be a bad choice at
Interesting.
All.
Yeah.
You know, that he's a really good choice, I think, personally. Somebody that I saw just recently who, Shia LaBeouf, everyone's going to hate me for suggesting it, but Shia LaBeouf whatever else you think about his public persona and people, it's funny when people get annoyed by a person that they see publicly in their public behavior. So they suddenly think they wouldn't be good in movies. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense, okay? Shia LaBeouf, and frankly, even his public stuff. I mean, he's done some real jerk stuff, like, you know, getting drunk and fighting a homeless person or whatever that was. And he has some self-control issues, but he's also somebody that came into the cinema business young. And we know that the pressure and the temptations and the exploitation of young performers is rampant in Hollywood. And that affects people, and he's had some substance abuse issues or, you know, some. But at the end of the day, he's a terrific performer. He's extremely talented. He takes his art very seriously, and he can commit and really deliver.
Yeah.
And I think if looking at him when he's walking around New York with a big furry beard and he works out, his height plays into it. And realistically, okay, he's hard drinking, doesn't care sometimes, gets in bar fights, that's Wolverine, okay?
Yeah.
So Shia LaBeouf as a possible, if they want to go with a younger, so somewhat younger casting for Wolverine, I think he'd be a good choice.
Interesting, because there is a whole controversy between whether Wolverine should be short and more boxy shaped, as in the comics, versus taller and more cut, as we see with Hugh Jackman. So it'll be interesting to see how they recast that. And once again, I'm going to be listening to this or just laying in bed tonight, and suddenly it's going to pop into my head, like my perfect choice for Wolverine, and I'm going to regret it so bad that I didn't think of it during
the
show.
I'll tell you a crazy one that it's going to sound ridiculous until you go Google what he looks like now that he's like gotten slim and muscular from working out.
Yeah.
Jonah Hill. Look at Jonah Hill lately.
Interesting.
Think about his acting potential. He has comedic acting ability, but he's got great dramatic chops as well. We saw in Wolf of Wall Street and plenty of other movies. Look what he looks like. If you Google right now while we're talking, Jonah Hill 2018,
yeah,
and look at the pictures of him walking around the street, muscular and slim, but he's also short. He still has a bit of a square boxiness to his build, even though he's slimmed down and has gotten more muscular. And when he doesn't shave, he is a hairy guy. And if you want somebody who's hairy and could look the part and has good acting chops and is an outside-the-box kind of casting choice, I think he'd be a terrific choice for Wolverine. And I like the idea of trying to think outside the box for some of these casting things and not just going for the, you know, the, oh, well, we want somebody who's 30 years old and is a martial artist with no acting experience, which is what most fans tend to do, is they point to pro wrestlers and martial arts experts who don't have really good acting chops or acting experience.
Yeah, you know what?
I don't want to see that.
You might be spot on, because now I'm looking at, I think, the picture that you're talking about. He's wearing a blue tank top. And,
yes, that's it.
and he's ripped. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, and he's got
crazy.
The facial hair. I'm going, wow, you know what? You might be right on this. The other one I was thinking of, actually, and strangely enough for Wolverine, was Alden Ehrenreich, the new Han Solo.
He's not a bad choice. I think I can see that.
He could be another Wolverine. What happened with the Han Solo movie? What killed that movie?
I think it was, in a nutshell, I think they released it 5 months after the last Star Wars movie, mm-hmm. which I liked the Last Jedi, even though I had some complaints about it.
Yeah, me too.
It was a good movie, but realistically, it got mixed. It had some there was some controversy and mixed reactions somewhat among fans to it. I think that was one thing, was releasing it in too close of a proximity. I think Star Wars benefits from a Christmas release, and people have come to get their heads around the idea of Star Wars as a Christmas film, a Christmas time film. So I think it would have performed a lot better in a December release.
Mm-hmm.
I also think the reason Star Wars movies are doing $1 to $2 billion right now is not just the Star Wars brand itself, but specifically a whole new generation of fans who've come on board because, I'm going to say the D word, diversity. These are films that have had female leads and had a very diverse cast,
yep,
with a lot of racial diversity in the cast and among the... that matters to people. And the Star Wars Han Solo movie was a film that was much more geared toward the older audiences who have the nostalgia for the older characters.
Yeah.
But the original trilogy characters aren't the ones that are primarily driving the $1 to $2 billion global obsession with the new movies. It's the new cast and the new characters, honestly, I think, that are really pushing it over the top in terms of popularity. So when you make a Solo movie, you're counting on the older audience and the nostalgia for the old characters. So you're pointing, you're really kind of, your target demographic is different than the target demo for the other newer Star Wars films. And that demographic for Solo, the older nostalgia demographic, were not as inclined to accept a new performer in that role,
in my
opinion. So I think that worked against it. And then add in the fact that there was all this negative publicity and they had to reshoot it. The combination of the timing, not being at Christmas and being in close proximity to Last Jedi, plus going for the nostalgia audience, which is not what drove the popularity as much of the new movies, and the fact that that audience doesn't want a new Han Solo actor, and then the marketing, I think, they hid him in the marketing.
You didn't really see
Han Solo very much. He didn't get to talk much, and you didn't get to really get a feel for him in the role. So all of that, I think, combined to really hurt the movie a lot.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because I like it.
I love it. In fact, after The Force Awakens, it's my favorite of the latter-day Star Wars movies, the more recent Star Wars movies. Yeah, and if you take that movie in a vacuum, it is an unequivocal hit. It was a great film in and of itself. And you know what I think? I think everything you mentioned as far as all of those factors that led to it not being as well received as it should have been, are all valid. I, you know, ultimately, I think you can bundle all of that together and say that it was the internet that killed Solo, a Star Wars movie. I think it was I think a lot of the fanboys had trouble with it because they were reading, as I was, about the reshoots and all the controversy that was happening behind the scenes, acting coaches for Alden Ehrenreich and so on. And that kind of dampened some energy for it. And then from an outside point of view, from a regular movie going point of view, I think it was maybe too much. I think it was just, well, we just saw The Last Jedi and, oh my God, there's another Star Wars movie. Or they just didn't, it just whizzed past people's heads because they're still thinking about Episode 8 rather than another Star Wars movie right on its heels. So it was maybe an oversaturation thing, which of course is furthered and augmented by the existence of constant internet social media bombardment by all of these things. So all those things combined made for a bit of a problem. But once again, much like I think Zack Snyder's movies, Solo in the long run is going to be much better regarded than it was in its initial run. So I hope Disney is at least to some extent keeping that on a back burner that they could maybe revisit if it does pick up steam after the fact. So I know I've kept you way long here, but I want to ask you before we go, who are some of your favorites for which films are some of your favorites for the Oscars this year? You said there were 23 best picture options.
Yeah, I've got right now I'm assembling my list of contenders and trying to figure out like which ones are in which category. And so far I've got 23 and counting.
Wow.
I think, you know, just off the top of my head, You Were Never Really Here, I think is a contender at the very least. I think Lynn Ramsey needs to be on the best director's list. The films that I think, I mean, if I'm going to name the films I think are the very likely to get nominations, A Star is Born is the film that I think is going to get nominated. And I right now, I think it's probably the film that's going to win for Best Picture. I think Boy Erased is going to get nominated. I think Green Book is going to get nominated.
Green Book, yeah.
I think Sorry to Bother You is probably, I know a lot of people think that it's a little bit too quirky, but I think it will end up, and I think it's going to be in a lot of people's top three on their ballots for the nominations. And if a film gets enough top three, if it's in one of the top three spots on enough ballots, it's going to get nominated. And I think it will. I think Sorry to Bother You will get nominated, and it deserves to. I think Vice is Adam McKay, who and Christian Bale.
Oh my God.
I think that movie is going to get a lot of attention.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Black Klansman is a contender. I think Beautiful Boy, First Man.
Yeah, I was going to say that one too.
I think Bohemian Rhapsody and The Favorite are both going to get nominated. Roma, Alfonso Cuarón is a Netflix movie, which is going to work against it because there's a lot of bias against it and there's a lot of pressure from producers who don't want Netflix movies to be allowed into consideration. Steven Spielberg, for example, said he thinks that Netflix movies and Amazon movies should not even be allowed into consideration for the awards.
Yeah, you know, GoldDerby.com has Roma as number two on the list of best picture possibilities.
Yeah, I think it's a very likely contender because the reactions to the film and the quality of the film, you're looking at something that it's going to be hard for the Academy voters to justify not nominating it. And it will be obvious that it was entirely based on bias against Netflix if they do overlook it. And it would undermine the integrity of the Oscars tremendously if they're simply on principle not nominating a movie because of the studio who makes it isn't putting it into theaters or whatever it is. So that's the kind of thing that has no business affecting nominations, and I think it's really disappointing and wrongheaded that people are even suggesting that Netflix films shouldn't be considered. I think I can't believe anyone who respects cinema or art would say such a horrible thing.
Yeah. Even the original series, even the limited series, the original series they're doing on Netflix and other streaming services, Amazon Prime and so on, have such a cinematic quality to them. It seems to me as if that's got to be viewed eventually as being a wing of filmmaking, as a wing of what we would see in an Oscar category, for example.
Oh, yeah. Anyone that says that Netflix movies aren't real cinema or aren't true films, I think one of two things is true. Either they don't know their ass from a hole in the ground, or they're just being extremely dishonest. Because if you watch The Beast of No Nation or First They Killed My Father, and you think those films, I mean, both of those films were better than half the movies that actually got nominated for Best Picture the years they released. That's the fact. They were.
Yeah.
They're spectacular. They're brilliant cinema and incredible filmmaking. And the same with, you know, a film like Roma. If you're looking at these things and claiming that they aren't real film and that they shouldn't be nominated for the Oscar, then I just question, what do you think should be nominated? How do you even? It's absurd. It's just ridiculous.
Should the Academy add this most popular movie category to the Oscars?
You know what? I'll say yes. I'll be controversial and say yes, because the idea of the Oscars is to honor what's great in cinema. It's a celebration of Hollywood and of a whole industry. And people may not like this truth being stated, but it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that isn't really represented at the Oscars right now, it's all about the art and the quality of the individual unions and the individual guilds, and then the greatest film that represents art. But there's no real like category that represents the business side and the success side of it. And I don't think that it's having that category isn't somehow going to weaken other categories. It's a valid, realistic category. Popularity of movies and films that were extremely successful and represent, you know, what films were represented enormous success in the context of their filmmaking and were also artistically the best of the films that were huge successes.
Yeah.
I think we can rationally, I don't think that's any harder to look at and determine than it is to say which performer was better than another. All of this stuff is about drawing lines and making judgments, and I think you can do that for popular film as well. And I think the Academy realistically still has a bias against certain types of films, nominating them, and it's certainly rewarding them with a statue. So if they're recognizing that and saying, look, there are films that deserve attention and that are great, but that are simply because of the way the rules work and because of the makeup of the Academy voters, these are films that are unlikely to otherwise show up in Best Picture or anywhere else.
Yeah.
But they are great achievements in popular cinema, and they deserve attention too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fair to say that. And I don't think it's going to ruin the Oscars or ruin the integrity of the Oscars to admit that.
Yeah. And you know what? It's interesting. And I agree with you 100%. My only caveat with this particular controversial category of most popular movie in the Oscars is that it seemed to me as if it would tend to preclude adding a movie that just happened to be popular into the Best Picture category. Like, for example, this past year, I think Black Panther should be in the Best Picture running, although it's probably just going to get relegated to Best Sound Editing, Best Editing, et cetera, the usual Best Visual Effects, the usual categories for movies like that. But it seemed to me as if you add that most popular picture, sometimes that could end up being this trash can where all the popular movies, even if they are Best Picture caliber, would end up just getting tossed away into that category. That's a minor concern compared to what the upside would be.
I think that's a valid concern. Yeah. I think on the one hand, it's easy to forget that the Academy Awards nominated Mad Max Fury Road for Best Picture.
I know.
And, you know, they nominated Arrival for Best Picture. They nominated all of the Lord of the Rings movies for Best Picture.
Yeah.
They nominated Avatar for Best Picture. So they do nominate popular films, including fantasy and sci-fi and, you know, those kind of things do get nominated. I mean, Toy Story 3, they even will nominate films. They'll cross-pollinate. Toy Story 3 was nominated for Best Picture and Best Animated Film.
Yeah.
Back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's, but at the same time, we know there is a bias against certain types of movies. But I also think that when we talk about the bias against films that we like, we need to be careful, because sometimes maybe, you know, there's a lot of people in the Academy that are voting. And when you look at the films that come out each year, what I was just talking about earlier, there are 23 movies and counting that I can name that are valid contenders for Best Picture. And of those 23, you could pick 8 to 10 of any of them, just randomly throw darts at a board, and yeah, you'd have a pretty great selection of films. So when we say, oh, they just don't like superhero movies, well, okay, but aren't people allowed to have a taste? And I don't like that. And yeah, I think the having a bias against it and refusing to consider it no matter what the quality is a mistake. But I also realize a lot of people are just voting their conscience and voting what they honestly prefer, and that's what their preferences are. So if it's not superhero movies, it's not always just a bias. That mm-hmm. said, there is bias, and I do agree with you that if there's a popular film category, it will make it perhaps there's a danger that the Academy will not feel pressure to address the biases that do exist in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think reverse would be true. I think if there's a popular film category and Academy voters get used to the idea of watching and then nominating superhero films and movies, sci-fi movies and fantasy films more often, the more acceptable that becomes within the popular film category, the more that they're going to be watching those movies they might have missed, the more they're going to take them seriously and have to think about what makes one set of films better than another, and that could end up influencing them to consider those films for Best Picture as well.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Well, you know what, Mark? I could sit here and literally spend hours going. I mean, we could have spent hours, as far as I'm concerned, on the DCEU, and everyone's going, oh, my God, the Snyder Cut. So shut up about the Snyder Cut, Bob. But you know what? I it's true. I could have spent hours talking to you about all these things, but I got to let you go. Meanwhile, where can people find you on social media?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Mark Hughes Films, although you might not want to because I talk a lot about my opinions about everything there. So, but you can find me there, and you can, of course, read me over at Forbes. I always review films and talk about cinema and genre entertainment and box office there. And I'm co-host of the Superhero News Channel with Sean Gerbers. He's the main host of the Superhero News wow. Channel on YouTube.
Oh, that's fantastic. And of course, you also have plenty of opinions in terms of what's going on in politics, too. So that's you're definitely a good follow when it comes to that sort of material as well. So
I'll
really
be on NPR next Monday, too. Just by the way, people can hear me 11 a.m. Pacific time in I'll be on NPR doing an interview about Stan Lee.
Oh, fantastic. And by the way, you can also find Mark's columns on Forbes.com at Forbes.com/sites/Mark Hughes. That's Mark with a K. Thank you again, my friend. And we're going to have to do this again very, very soon, maybe during Oscar
Definitely.
Season.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it.